Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
Support for On Point and the following message comes from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Lift the burden of getting a home loan with Rocket Mortgage and get a secure, transparent home loan approval in minutes. Skip the bank, skip the waiting, and go completely online at quickenloans.com/onpoint.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. This week, a Trump budget, tough numbers on the GOP healthcare bill, a U.S. threat in Korea, and no evidence for the wiretap charge. The White House replacement order banning travel from six nations, blocked by a judge in Hawaii. In Nashville, President Trump was adamant.
This is a watered-down version. And let me tell you something. I think we ought to go back to the first one and go all the way, which is what I wanted to do in the first place.
Republican infighting over health care. On Thursday, Senator Rand Paul told MSNBC Paul Ryan's replacement health care plan won't survive.
No conservative is for his plan, and so I think his plan's dead on arrival. My hope is it never leaves the House.
And no evidence yet supporting President Trump's claim that President Obama wiretapped him in Trump Tower. White House counselor Kellyanne Conway tried to broaden the options.
You can surveil someone through their phones, through their certainly through their television sets, any number of different ways, and microwaves that turn into cameras, et cetera.
Et cetera, et cetera. This hour On Point, our weekly news roundtable with Nancy Cordes of CBS News, Adam Smith of the Tampa Bay Times, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. What do you make of President Trump's budget, of the health care bill numbers, the claims of wiretapping? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining us today from Washington is Nancy Cordes, congressional correspondent for CBS News. Nancy, it's great to have you with us. Thanks for joining us.
Good to be with you, Tom.
With me today in Tampa, Florida, where On Point is in town for our national listening tour, is Adam Smith, political editor for the Tampa Bay Times. Adam, welcome to On Point.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
And from Boston, Jack Beatty joins us. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, Adam, and Nancy.
Here we are in Tampa, looking out at the whole country and looking in particular at Washington. Lots going on this week. And the latest is this Trump budget, the skinny budget, Nancy. Not fully fleshed out, but there's a lot in there. It's getting a lot of attention. How would you describe the first reaction to President Trump's budget on the table, Nancy?
Well, it ranges from Republican reaction, which is essentially that the budget is a non-starter, to Democratic reaction, which is that this budget is cruel and inhumane. So it is essentially in this form, dead on arrival on Capitol Hill. It has these very draconian cuts to the State Department, to domestic programs, to the EPA. But the biggest problem Republicans have with it are those diplomatic cuts. They say every dollar you cut from diplomacy is $2 you'd have to spend on defense. It makes our men and women in the military less safe. It pushes us into more conflicts, and it makes the conflicts that we're already in more difficult to manage.
Adam Smith, we're here in Tampa, and we're hearing people saying, well, President Trump said he wanted to go after the administrative state. He said he wanted to cut back the federal budget, but the net effect of this budget might be to hurt a lot of people who voted for Donald Trump. It would go at local development. It would go at some rural development. It might take, airport and development funds away from rural areas and others where he did quite well. What about that potential impact here?
Well, I think for the people that support him, and we're in Tampa Bay, which is sort of the swing area of the biggest swing state in America. Mm-hmm. This is an area that helped deliver the state to Donald Trump.
A close victory, but he got it.
He got it. And I think a lot of people would say, well, isn't this what he campaigned on? He never promised he was going to be cutting deficits, which this budget certainly doesn't do. He promised he was going to be spending a lot of money on the military, and he promised he was going to be cutting bureaucracy. He was no friend of the EPA, the Education Department. Mm-hmm. This is sort of what he campaigned on, and this is what he's delivering.
Jack Beatty, which cuts are you looking at here, and which deeper, bigger ladles of new money are you seeing?
Well, it's all for defense, $54 billion, a good deal, more money for the Homeland Security, some for veterans, which is welcome. But the emphasis on hard power prompted David Brooks to observe that the Trump budget looks less like a political philosophy and more like a sexual fantasy. Everything for hard power, nothing for that lily-livered stuff about the arts and about economic development and about PBS. And hard. And it is, as Nancy said, hard-hearted as well as really hard-headed. It's almost certainly dead on arrival and a welcome mortality.
Nancy, is it really just the diplomatic cuts that have the Republicans concerned here? I mean, we know General Mattis, before he was confirmed as Secretary of Defense, said a couple of years back, if you cut the State Department, I'm going to have money for more troops. But is that all that has Republicans worried? Are they worried that the cuts that hit home close to their constituencies may, in fact, cause pain that causes them trouble?
Sure. And that's always a problem, right? You've got lots of budget hawks on Capitol Hill, but suddenly when a program that affects their constituents is in the crosshairs, they feel quite differently. And so that's part of it. But you've also got Republican members saying, look, I've got constituents, I've got family members who have benefited from Meals on Wheels, for instance, or after school programs. And I think part of the problem that they have is we've seen very tough budgets come out from the former budget chair, Paul Ryan, in the past. But those even those plans take more of a scalpel to the budget. And this is really a sledgehammer. When you're talking about cutting one third of the State Department's budget in 1 year, that is really shocking, even to a lot of budget hawks on Capitol Hill. And that has a lot of them saying that this budget doesn't seem just to reflect Donald Trump's values, but also Mick Mulvaney's values, who is now the director of the Office of Management and Budget at the White House and was one of the most conservative members of the House before he was tapped to do that job.
Here at a press conference yesterday, the Office of Management and Budget's Mick Mulvaney, who's in charge of the White House budget, now was asked about those plans to cut federal programs like Meals on Wheels.
You're only focusing on half of the equation, right? You're focusing on recipients of the money. We're trying to focus on both the recipients of the money and the folks who give us the money in the first place. And I think it's fairly compassionate to go to them and say, look, we're not going to ask you for your hard-earned money anymore.
Wall Street Journal editorial saying this morning, Adam, that, look, this is a taste of what's to come if we don't get on top of the national budget deficit. If we don't look at entitlements, which Donald Trump doesn't really want to do with Social Security, though there's some cuts in Medicaid coming into the new health care reform. Wall Street Journal, conservative view of things, was saying this is the way it's going to be. We're not going to have money for a lot of these things if we don't rein this in. What about that argument?
Well, and I think if you look at the big picture here, for the people, the voters and Trump supporters that aren't paying attention to the details of this budget proposal, what they wanted in Donald Trump was somebody who's going to blow up Washington. And so if you have a lot of people screaming, yelling about this budget is crazy, this is something we can't accept, that's exactly what people wanted. They wanted somebody who's going to shake things up, and this budget is scaring a lot of establishment politicians.
Nancy, what happens here? If this is DOA with Republicans on Capitol Hill, does this just go on a shelf somewhere and they do their own from scratch?
Yes, because the presidential budget is always essentially a proposal, whether it gets approved or not by Congress. At the end of the day, it's Congress that sets funding levels, and it's Congress that submits its own budget and then and tries to act off of it. So this is what's really remarkable here is that typically you don't have members of the president's own party slamming the president's budget. And I think part of the disagreement here has been Mulvaney, as you just played in that clip, coming out yesterday and saying, you know, these programs just don't work. And so we're not going to pay for things anymore that just don't work. And so that has put a lot of pressure on Republicans to essentially defend these programs in their communities and say, well, this one works and that one works. And, you know, if you don't want to spend as much money on it, that's one thing. But just saying that nothing, you know, that feeding low-income people or giving children meals or after-school care just doesn't work, that's another matter.
Let's get a quick call right here. Anne in Burlington, Vermont. Anne, we're listening from Tampa, Florida. What do you think?
Well, I think that the Meals on Wheels program works beautifully. I don't sound it, but I'm 84, and I've got a wheelchair right under me right now.
Okay.
And if it wasn't for Meals on Wheels, they have a volunteer group of amazing human beings who deliver Meals on Wheels. They are not paying these people for this incredible service. This is my 15 minutes of fame every day when they knock on the door and bring me a well-balanced meal with, and they have been cut before this, with proteins, with the beans and the rice. Who knew? They are very intelligent about the way they do things and create these meals. I grew up Middle Eastern, and every now and then I take a holiday from Meals on Wheels and cook Middle Eastern for myself and enjoy it. But these people are amazing. What they are doing is keeping elders off Medicare bills because they're giving them nutritionally balanced meals. Where is the stupidity in this? They're complaining about Medicare and Medicaid.
And I get it. I get it. I mean, I grew up with my church members delivering Meals on Wheels all the time, all over the place in my hometown. But, you know, Trump and the White House say, we don't have enough for everything. If it weren't there, what would you do? And would you find another way? Would friends, neighbors, relatives come and help you get the food, the nutrition you need?
I have no clue. I haven't gone there yet because I'm hoping that intelligence will win out over greed.
Anne, watching from her wheelchair at 84 in Burlington, Vermont, Anne, we wish you good luck with that. Hey, speaking of cuts, Nancy, I see the Corporation for Public Broadcasting zeroed out in this budget. Should I be looking for a new job?
You know, not unless, as you pointed out to Anne, that money can come from somewhere else. You know, there are a lot of programs, including public broadcasting, that take very steep hits under this budget, including medical research, the Centers for Disease Control, a lot of very vital functions that that this White House is going after. And part of the reason, as you pointed out, is because President Trump has made a promise not to touch entitlements. That's where the bulk of the money is, in Medicare and Social Security. There are a lot of Republicans on Capitol Hill who would love to talk about those programs and look at reforms there. But if those are off the table, there aren't that many other places the money can come from.
Jack, Nancy says vital, but who's judging what's vital now?
Well, Anne, I think, defines vitality right there. That was a stirring defense, and Nick Mulvaney should hear it.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking at a week in the news. President Trump's budget, the CBO scores scoring the Republican health care reform. The president debunked on wiretapping by leaders in his own party. And Rex Tillerson says that military action is an option with North Korea. Of course, it's been working on nuclear weapons and their delivery. We're broadcasting today from the studios of WUSF in Tampa, Florida. Adam Smith is with us from the Tampa Bay Times. Nancy Cordes from CBS News in Washington, congressional correspondent there. Jack Beatty is with us, and you can join us as well. What do you think of this budget? What will, what should Republicans do on health care, Trump care? Cut the number covered by 24 million. Is it worth it? And when Rex Tillerson says North Korea and military action in the same breath, what are you thinking? I want to turn to the big healthcare action, but a couple more calls on the budget first. Owensboro, Kentucky, Zach is calling. Hi, Zach, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. I just wanted to say, you know, Trump has based his whole campaign and so far his presidency on making America great again. And, you know, this budget cut does not leave any room for that. I mean, you know, we have, what is it, a 51 or 53% proposed budget for military spending, and he wants to cut these programs. Why not start literally at home instead of sending our money, you know, to military actions overseas? Why not start at home? Why not, you know, make sure that children are fed and that the elderly are taken care of and that our homeless veterans that, you know, need that he promised so much in his campaign to take care of? Why not make sure these people are taken care of? Why not start with our future and our children and, you know, our past with our seniors and our
Zach,
veterans?
We've got it. We've got it right here in Tampa. Let me put it to Adam Smith. Okay, Adam, I'm going to put you in the role of Sean Spicer or Donald Trump. Respond to Zach. that America's military needs to be the strongest. It's a dangerous world. He repeatedly was on the trail. He won election saying that the Obama administration had decimated the military and we were going to build it up and we were going to be less aggressive in using our military overseas. This is what he campaigned on. Now, I will say he did not campaign on cutting a lot of social programs. I think that it's a mystery whether the principles are guided by Donald Trump or Steve Bannon and some of his administration. But he did say he wanted to cut the bureaucracy.
And now we got the numbers on the table. There are impacts. Tracy in Atlanta, Georgia. Tracy, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Tom. Hi. I just wanted to say that I think that Democrats or people who did not support Trump, I really think that we should stop fighting Trump on his budget proposals, his health care proposals, and let his supporters feel the repercussions of the things that he's proposing. Because I think it makes us look like we are just opposing him for the sake of opposing him. And honestly, it's because it's bad policy. I think if they think his health care is great, I think they should have it. I think if they think his budget is great, let them have it. Because it is mainly going to affect his supporters.
Tracy's willing to take a deep breath and just let it all go through and see how the cards fall. Jack, you know, we're in Tampa on a listening tour. We were out in the West Tampa sandwich shop yesterday talking with a bunch of folks, including Trump supporters there. And they were saying the same thing, but with a different gist. They were saying, just let him do it. This is the change we want. This is the change we voted for. Stop griping. Stop opposing everything. Let the man do his work. Now, Tracy in Atlanta says, let him do it. It's going to fall hard on the people who voted for him. There's two versions of what letting him do it would mean, Jack.
Yes, there are. And nothing illustrates that more vividly than he wants to eliminate the Appalachian Regional Commission, which serves 420 counties in 13 states. He won 399 of those counties. So this is a program that deals in economic development that serves an area that desperately needs every iota of economic development, and he wants to attack it. That's why David Brooks's column is titled "Trump to Working Class Drop Dead." You know, Trump was known as in his Trump University and the way he stiffed his contractors over the years. He was sort of a scam artist, at least as regards the people who worked for him, who did work at some of these and paid tuition at his school. And this is this makes his campaign and his, some of his promises, I'm going to protect you, everything's going to be fine, look like a scam. And he's, I think, waking up to this. At least on the healthcare bill, he seemed with Tucker Carlson to be aware that when Tucker Carlson said, this is going to hurt the very people who voted for you, he said, well, I know that, and we're going to take care of them. Well, it remains to be seen, and it seems like it's very unlikely he's going to be able to change anything very fundamental in that bill.
Nancy Cordes, how would the administration do that, deliver for the people who voted him into office? Or are you saying that's not going to happen? We're just not going to see this profile of budget ultimately implemented.
I think it's hard to deliver on promises when you promise across the board that you're going to make everybody happy. Let's look at healthcare as a perfect example of that. The president has said that everyone's going to be covered, but costs are also going to go down and there are going to be more choices and more plans. And what Republicans are finding is you just can't, that's just not possible. And you have to make very painful trade-offs. And Democrats who went through this painful process when they were coming up with Obamacare said, you know, yeah, we had to live with the fact that we were making trade-offs. The president doesn't seem to believe that he has to make any trade-offs, but that puts Republicans in an impossible position when they're trying to sell their bill. It's never going to live up to the promises that the president has made.
Let's listen to the sound of gears grinding on the health care front this week. Of course, Democrats came out very strong. Congressional Budget Office came out and said this would mean 24 million more people losing health care coverage by a decade or so from now, less than that, I guess. It would also mean $300+ billion in savings. Democrats jumped all over it. This was on Tuesday. New York Democrat Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer urging the GOP to pull its health care proposal.
Trump care means higher costs for less coverage. The CBO report should be a knockout blow for Republicans in Congress. They should heed this warning and turn back from their plan that would be a disaster for the country.
Disaster for the country, says the Democratic leader. But here you have Republican Senator Tom Cotton of Arkansas. This is on ABC's This Week, saying GOP members of the House approval of the Republican health care bill would put the entire GOP agenda at risk.
I would say to my friends in the House of Representatives with whom I serve, do not walk the plank and vote for a bill that cannot pass the Senate and then have to face the consequences of that vote.
Okay, Nancy Cordes with CBS, we've got to come back to you. Describe these internal Republican tensions now. You've got conservatives looking at this one way, other Republicans looking at it another. I mean, never mind the Democrats, though we will pay attention to what they're saying here. But what's the internal party dynamic on the Hill? And then between the Hill, this three-way with the dynamic with the White House as well. What are the tensions there, Nancy?
It is incredibly difficult. You know, the House Speaker is kind of a, you know, never let him see a sweat type of guy. And so for a few days after this devastating Congressional Budget Office report came out, he was saying, look, I think it's a great report. Nothing wrong with it. I'm encouraged by it. But the White House and Republican rank and file acknowledged that any report that shows that 24 million people are going to lose coverage is a big problem. So they're trying to address that problem. They're trying to address the concerns of moderate Republicans who say that this is going to leave too many people out in the cold. But they're also trying to address concerns from conservatives who say we don't leave those people out in the cold fast enough. We need to cut Medicaid quicker. We need to cut those generous tax credits. And so they're just in a room trying to thread the needle, find a way to get to 220 Republican votes in the House, knowing that it will undergo massive changes in the Senate if it survives at all. And the reason that they can't tell us publicly what the changes are that they're making is, you know, that I think that they're not even quite sure right now what they can do to tweak this bill that will get the magic number that they need.
Adam Smith with the Tampa Bay Times, I mean, you're in Florida. How's the Florida delegation dealing with this? We saw these numbers from the Congressional Budget Office that were really eye-popping on what this change would mean for seniors. And if I recall the numbers correctly, it was something like if you were a senior basically living on Social Security, $26,000 or something like that income, in a few years, your health care coverage would cost you $14,000 just for the premiums. How are Florida Congress people dealing with this?
Well, it's sort of a microcosm for the trouble that they're facing across the country. You see Cuban American Republicans in Miami-Dade who have tend to be more moderate. They're fiercely opposed to this because of the impact on their constituents. And you have Tea Party Republicans in the rest of the state that are fiercely opposed to it because they don't think it's conservative enough. Our governor, Rick Scott, is a made tens of millions of dollars as a controversial healthcare CEO. He, the day after it came out or so, he sounded very enthusiastic about it. Now he's virtually unwilling to discuss it when asked about it. So it's clearly in trouble if you just look at where things are in Florida.
And then there's a whole philosophy behind it. We had Paul Ryan. He was on Face the Nation on Sunday talking with John Dickerson. And Dickerson asked him how many people would lose health coverage under the House Republican health care plan. This is before the numbers came out, but there's a philosophical point he's making here. Here's Ryan's response.
I can't answer that question. It's up to people. Here's the premise of your question. Are you going to stop mandating people buy health insurance? People are going to do what they want to do with their lives because we believe in individual freedom in this country. So the question is, are we providing a system where people have access to health insurance if they choose to do so? And the answer is yes.
There's the word. There's the word that's been the umbrella that Paul Ryan's been trying to use here, Jack Beatty, access. What does he mean by that, and what would that actually be?
Well, he seems to mean by it a version of Anatole France's famous line about the rich and the poor have equal right to sleep under the Paris bridges, because that's effectively what this means. I mean, somewhere in the future, the Republicans claim, premiums will go down by 10%. That'll make them affordable. People who will then be able to buy insurance. And moreover, they'll be free people because they will have been freed from this umbrageous weight of the Obama coercion compelling them to buy insurance. But they still won't have any more money. How they're going to buy the insurance, it remains to be seen. You know, what's striking about this is the Ayn Rand selfish, immoral aspect of this. I mean, what else can you call but immoral a program that would cut taxes on the top 2% by $900 billion over a decade and cut spending on the poorest Americans by almost the same amount? It's a redistribution from the bottom to the top. Only in a social Darwinist world that Paul Ryan seems to think is paradise could that kind of thing pass.
Nancy, is freedom is worth everything here? Is that the Paul Ryan approach? But he believes people will end up with good health care, or they can end up in the emergency room and somebody will take care of them at the end.
Right. That is his long-held belief for many years, that people make the best decisions for themselves, that government should get out of the way, that if you remove all of these regulations, that it will unleash market forces and competition like you've never seen before, and that will end up driving prices down. The challenge for him has been that the Congressional Budget Office did not find that that would be the case, at least not within the next 10 years. Essentially, what the CBO said is that premiums will still go up. They just will go up 10% less than they would go up under Obamacare. So the notion that people who now have smaller tax credits will suddenly be so thrilled by this premium increase that's only 10% smaller than Obamacare to run out and buy their own insurance, which, by the way, will be more challenging because you're eliminating the exchanges that kind of made it easier for them to comparison shop for those plans. You know, maybe some people would do it. I'm sure they would. But the notion that 24 million people are going to do it is pretty far-fetched.
Let's turn and look at the travel ban, which this week was the revised version, stopped again this time by a judge, a federal district court judge in Honolulu, Derek Watson, blocking President Trump's ban on travel from parts of the Muslim world. It had already been stopped last time. They'd gone back to the drawing board. They came out with a new plan here. And boom, a judge comes in again and puts a temporary halt on it. On Wednesday, just hours after that, district judge in Hawaii blocked the revised travel ban. President Trump addressed a crowd of thousands in Nashville and said this.
You don't think this was done by a judge for political reasons, do you? No. This ruling makes us look weak, which, by the way, we no longer are, believe me.
Makes us look weak, attacking the judiciary there. And this is on hold again, Adam Smith. What do you expect now? A fight in the courts all the way to the Supreme Court? And how does this leave the Trump administration and the courts looking as they butt heads again?
Well, I think it could very well wind up all the way to the Supreme Court. And Donald Trump seems to be in perpetual campaign mode. There's nothing he likes better than a fight and challenging institutions like the court. Yeah, but does it make the country look weak? I don't know. But Donald Trump is more than happy to be calling out judges whenever he can and calling out the establishment.
Jack, this judge said, well, how can you say there's no religious test in here? Look back at his rhetoric on the campaign trail. Of course, when he called for a total and complete shutdown of Muslims entering the United States, the judge pulling all of that back up and saying, you can't walk away from this now. We can see you've expressed that this is in the back of your mind. We can't ignore that.
Yes, we have to look past the text, as the judge says, to the context. And the context is the surround of statements that you instance. Now, that's controversial, whether you can go behind texts like that to look at what people who were then in private life said. But it sure sounded sure sounded like American strength to me. The strength of our system is that we are a system of laws, not men. That we cumber the presidency and all centers of power with countervailing power. And here were the courts saying this does not comport with our charter document. This is not consistent with the exclusion of religious discrimination under our First Amendment. And if you look at the subtext here, that's what this is all about. It's telling Muslims we don't want you because they're Muslim.
Nancy Curtis, what does the Trump administration do with his ruling now?
Well, they continue to fight in the court system. It doesn't seem like there's a lot of appetite for a third version to try to figure out something that will satisfy the courts, because what keeps fouling them up is what they said at the very beginning. And, you know, and no amount of new plans is going to change the way that they described their intent before they ever released the first version.
Support for On Point and the following message comes from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. When it comes to the big decision of choosing a mortgage lender, it's important to work with someone you can trust who has your best interests in mind. With Rocket Mortgage, you get a transparent online process that gives you the confidence you need to make an informed decision. Skip the bank, skip the waiting, and go completely online at quickenloans.com/onpoint. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states. NMLSConsumerAccess.org, number 3030.
Hi, it's Tom. Thanks for listening to this On Point podcast. I want you to take a moment to think about the people you care about. Have they ever listened to a podcast? All this month, we're asking our listeners to tell a friend about a podcast they love. This one? Another one? Do it in real life or on social media, and if they don't know how to download them, give them a quick lesson. You'll be opening up a new world for them. Tell us what you're recommending with the hashtag TryPod. That's hashtag TryPod. And thanks. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. In other news this week, Democratic New York Senator Kirsten Gillibrand talked about the sharing of photos of naked female service members on social media by fellow Marines.
It is a serious problem when we have members of our military denigrating female Marines who will give their life to this country in the way they have, with no response from leadership. I can tell you, your answers today are unsatisfactory.
That story not finished. After a viral video of a BBC expert's children barging in during an interview, Korea scholar Robert E. Kelly praised his wife for coming to the rescue on camera.
My wife deserves a medal for taking care of us and taking care of our family. That's absolutely true.
Kids still right there. And Daily Show host Trevor Noah had fun with MSNBC's Rachel Maddow's big noise about a little bit of Trump tax returns on her show earlier this week.
That's like saying, I have a tape of Trump saying the N-word, and then you go and press play, and Trump goes, Nintendo. It's not what we expected, Rachel. It's not what we expected.
Okay, but she did. But she did have some tax returns. We'll look at that. We're looking at a week in the news. President Trump's budget. Republicans wrestling with health care reform. The president sort of debunked on his wiretapping charge. Rex Tillerson in Asia saying that the time for strategic patience has ended on North Korea, talking about military action there. Nancy Cordes, congressional correspondent for CBS News, is with us today from Washington. Adam Smith, political editor for the Tampa Bay Times, is with us. We are in Tampa at the studios of WUSF on our national listening tour. Jack Beatty's here, and you can join us as well. Are you surprised when the court stopped Trump's travel ban again? Does this make America look weak, like the president says? And what does it tell you when Republican leaders say no wiretapping evidence and the president digs in anyway? Will you be turning in for the Russia hearings on Monday? For confirmation hearings on the Supreme Court, Neil Gorsuch, is your bracket already busted? It was a tough week for the president on his wiretapping charges that he had tweeted out on March 4th, saying, all kinds of noise about President Obama tapped the Trump Tower. On Wednesday, House Intelligence Committee Chairman and California Republican Congressman David Nunes said the evidence of wiretapping at Trump Tower has not changed, not there.
We don't have any evidence that that took place. And in fact, I don't believe, just in the last week of time, the people we've talked to, I don't think there was an actual tap of Trump Tower.
And we've got the Senate leadership coming out on the same front. There's a statement from Chairman Republican Richard Burr of North Carolina, along with Mark Warner of Virginia, saying, based on the information available to us, we see no indication that Trump Tower was the subject of surveillance by any element of the United States government either before or after Election Day 2016. The Senate Intelligence Committee, bipartisan leadership there. Nancy Cordes, we saw Sean Spicer going to great lengths to try and put a larger definition around what was meant here. We saw Kellyanne Conway say, well, there's all kinds of ways of surveilling. Even your microwave might take pictures of you. Is the White House left looking bad here? Do they dig in and wait? Is the Justice Department going to deliver something?
They look bad, and it's because they are not at liberty to back down on this debunked claim until the president himself is willing to back down on it. And as we saw in an interview the other night, he is not. He now insists that we will see this evidence within the next 2 weeks. The problem is that we have now heard from the Republican chairs of the House and Senate Intelligence Committee. We've heard from the Speaker of the House, all of whom say that not only do they not see any evidence that President Trump was wiretapped or anything else, any other kind of surveillance by President Obama, but they just point blank don't think that it happened. And we anticipate that on Monday, when the FBI director comes to Capitol Hill to testify, he will probably say the same thing in public. But the president is sticking with this assertion. He is coming up with more and more explanations for how he arrived at this conclusion. Now it seems that it wasn't that he got this information from intelligence sources, but from reading a variety of news articles that didn't really say what he claims that they said. And it is really creating a problem for this White House, because if you are not willing to back down on a claim that is clearly incorrect, it makes it much more difficult to make people believe you on other subjects when you are in the right.
Donald Trump in a tweet storm, March 4th. How low has President Obama gone to tap my phones during the very sacred election process? This is Nixon, Watergate, bad or sick guy. He said President Obama was tapping my phones in October, just prior to election. He said, is it legal for a sitting president to be wiretapping a race for president prior to an election? Here he was with Fox News host Tucker Carlson on Wednesday in Detroit this week, emphasizing that what he meant by wiretapping was in a broader sense.
Don't forget, when I say wiretap, those words were in quotes. That really covers, because wiretapping is pretty old-fashioned stuff, but that really covers surveillance and many other things. And nobody ever talks about the fact that it was in quotes, but that's a very important thing. But wiretap covers a lot of different things. I think you're going to find some very interesting items coming to the forefront over the next 2 weeks.
Well, I don't know. I'm looking at the tweets. Tap my phones, not in quotes. Tapping my phones, not in quotes. There was, yes, wiretapping in quotes. Adam Smith, how does this play?
You know, you look at the polling, and his poll numbers are historically horrific compared to other presidents at this point. But among his supporters, they have remained pretty strong. And we're in this bizarre, scary position where journalists, members of Congress, the public has to ask themselves, when do we have a president of the United States that we should ignore a significant amount of what he says because it's blatantly not true? At some point, when the rubber meets the road on things like the budget, healthcare reform, et cetera, and things don't work, that's when we'll really see if that support can remain steady.
Shane in Tampa, Florida. Shane, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks a lot for taking my call. Yeah, I heard you're really tall.
I'm tall enough.
My question is, does James Comey have more information on a Russia tie to Trump that the public knows? I would ask your guests, what do they know about that? Does he have something he's going to give to the public? We heard an announcement was due, but then it didn't come from him directly. Is it something that we're going to hear sooner or later?
It's a great question. I mean, we're going to hear something quite soon. On Monday, we've got this hearing. He's scheduled to be there. Nancy Cordes, what is known about what's being actively investigated and how much fire there may be behind all the smoke?
What is known is not enough, Tom, for us to really draw many conclusions. We do know that the House and Senate Intelligence Committees and the Gang of Eight on Capitol Hill are being routinely briefed by the FBI director. He's in high demand right now on Capitol Hill. And what they tell us, which is not much, when they come out of those briefings is, A, that they haven't seen evidence yet of any improper communications between Trump associates and Russian operatives, but that this investigation is ongoing. We haven't heard anything publicly from the FBI director. He has been extremely unwilling to share details about this investigation in public, so it'll be very interesting to see what he says and doesn't say on Monday when he is in this public setting for the first time and is sure to be pelted with questions about this, particularly from Democrats. And, you know, frankly, it's possible, and this is something that members of Congress worry about, that he knows things that he doesn't feel that he could share with them at this point. Congress can...
Like what? I mean,
can leak from time to time. Well, you know, I mean, anything having to do with Trump's campaign and his associates and their contact with the Russians. Certainly, you know, it has not gone unnoticed that a number of Trump associates have insisted that they never had any contact with Russian officials or Russian businessmen, only to then later have to acknowledge, oh, well, there was this one time, and oh, right, well, I forgot about that conversation because we really didn't discuss anything important. And there are enough instances of this happening that Democrats are highly suspicious. They say, where there's smoke, there must be fire. Republicans have been much more cautious. They say, we haven't seen any evidence of that fire yet, but our investigations are ongoing, and let's see where they lead.
I mean, on something as of such significance as this, Adam, you want to be cautious, you want to be careful, you want to get it right. Absolutely. On the other hand, it's frustrating to have the idea out there, and more than the idea, the U.S. intelligence community has said publicly Russia interfered in the U.S. elections, and they did so for president, for then-candidate Trump. The idea that you've got another country in the middle of our, what Donald Trump this week called the very sacred election process in a different context, or, I mean, in his tweet there, that is deeply unnerving. And if it happened once, it could happen again. How are we going to get to the bottom of this, Adam?
And also in the background, you have the fact that Comey was certainly not keeping his mouth shut at the very end of the election, making comments about Hillary Clinton's emails in a way that Republicans and Democrats alike agree helped elect Donald Trump.
He was right up in her grill on that.
So how does he now come and say before Congress that, I'm sorry, I have to be circumspect, I can't talk about this at all?
Jack, where does this leave us? The intelligence community saying it's happening or it happened. You know, continued sort of drip of new insights coming out. Is there evidence to support the hope, the belief that the Republican committees on Capitol Hill will really dig in here and ferret out what actually did or did not happen?
Well, I think it has to be encouraging this week that both the chairman of the House committee and the Senate committee, the Republican chairman, both made their statements saying they saw no evidence to support Trump's claim about President Obama's, quote, wiretapping. That was encouraging. That shows some sand on their part. They're willing to really defy their president on what on this issue that he's created. Now, does that augur for fair, impartial hearings? I don't know. And, of course, as has been observed, so many of these hearings, because they're in intelligence hearings, are going to be held in secret. We're not going to know what's said. We're only going to get cryptic summaries here and there. And that's a great shame because the public needs to know. And this not knowing may, in that sense, go on for a long time just because of the nature of the revelatory forum that is going to be used.
Nancy Cordes in Washington. On the other hand, I mean, Kellyanne Conway and Sean Spicer trying to – and the president himself trying to broaden the definition of what he meant with those allegations. Didn't we hear that at a certain point last fall, the administration was worried about Russian interference and did instruct U.S. intelligence to pay attention?
Sure, but that's very different from instructing intelligence to wiretap Trump Tower or conduct any other kind of surveillance on Trump Tower.
Couldn't it have had the same outcome? I mean, the suspicion was that it might be cooperation for Donald Trump.
Well, at that point in the campaign, the intelligence community hadn't even reached its conclusion yet that the Russians were definitively trying to put their thumb on the scale for Donald Trump. The conclusion at that point was just that the Russians were trying to meddle in our election system and decrease Americans' faith in the outcome. And so that's what they were focused on. They were focused on what the Russians were doing. And we're talking about the fake news. We're talking about whether they were trying to tamper with voting machines and that kind of thing. We're talking about them hacking the political apparatus. We're not talking so much about whether they were having conversations with Trump campaign officials. Now, that investigation may very well have been taking place, but President Obama himself does not have the power to tell the intelligence community to go and wiretap Donald Trump. He simply does not have the ability to do that. And so that is the problem with the accusation that was made by President Trump. He is claiming that for political reasons, his predecessor had surveillance conducted on Trump Tower. And in a very blanket statement, the Senate Intelligence Committee said, no, not wiretapping, not any kind of surveillance. Then you had Sean Spicer say, well, we've heard maybe that President Obama didn't use the U.S. intelligence apparatus. He might have asked the British intelligence apparatus, the British, demanded an apology for that because they said, this is nonsense. We had nothing to do with it. And now the White House has had to apologize.
Let's jump quickly from Tampa Bay, where we're sitting today, to the other side of the Pacific. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson is there. He doesn't talk often, but he talked yesterday at a press conference in Seoul, South Korea, about giving a signal that the Trump administration would consider taking military action against North Korea.
The policy of strategic patience has ended. We're exploring a new range of diplomatic, security, and economic measures. All options are on the table. North Korea must understand that the only path to a secure, economically prosperous future is to abandon its development of nuclear weapons, ballistic missiles, and other weapons of mass destruction.
Nancy Cordes, how hot is that language? Plenty of evidence of North Korean nuclear weapons development and missile testing in the last year. The policy of strategic patience has ended. Are we talking about really putting the sharp end of the spear in their face or just raising the pressure?
No question that there's a lot of muscular language there. No question that there's a lot of concern on Capitol Hill about how far can we go to try to pressure the North Koreans without stumbling into a conflict that there really doesn't seem to be any appetite for at this moment. Not a lot of military or diplomatic options. And so that's why they're hoping that, you know, this White House, which sometimes can be a little bit fast and loose with its language, will thread the needle here and try to put pressure on North Korea without, losing this, diplomatic alliance with other countries that enables us to some degree to keep North Korea in check.
Jack, real quick, in the Netherlands this week, we saw the right-wing populist Geert Wilders losing, not winning. High water mark for that kind of right-wing populism in Europe? Are we going to be the big country with the right-wing populists at the head and alone?
Well, we'll know in another few weeks when the French have their election and the right-wing candidate is up and looks to be losing, not in the middle, in the first round, but in the second. It may be that it has crested, but it's crested, that is, this right-wing populism, at a higher level than anyone would have thought possible just a few years ago.
And who knows, history, as we have all learned, has not ended. It's very much in gear, in progress. I want to thank all three of you for being with us and WUSF, NPR member station in Tampa, Florida, where we're broadcasting today. Adam Smith with the Tampa Bay Times, thanks so much for being here, Adam.
Thanks, Tom.
Nancy Cordes with CBS News in Washington. Thank you, Nancy.
Thank you.
And Jack, thank you. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.